Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an education service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments. These are destroyed legal arguments. When we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people. The Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wish I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but we haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from the political process, not from our politicians, lawyers, or bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me say the same thing in a little different way. You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, just call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school, is available on compact disc or adult home education. If you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Do that right now before you forget. That's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took up a subject called destroyed arguments. Destroyed legal arguments that have been used in court, some 30 of them, researched out by Larry B. Craft of Huntsville, Alabama. Larry put it on his website. I'll give you his website, see if I can find it again here on the document. It's kind of an odd way of spelling highway. Here it is here. It's http://high, and is it high or by? Look at that. No, it's flyhighway.net. http://fly.highway, H-I-W-A-A-Y.net. You have two A's in that highway.net. And you can get these cases. There's, oh hell, there must be 100 cases or more cited in here. 30 topics. All these arguments have been tested in court, primarily on income tax and willful failure to file and tax evasion, and they've all lost. And there's no need for you to go into court and lose on these loser arguments. Once they have been tested and once they've been proven to be losers, all you can do is do what the losers did. And if you do that, you will surely lose. If you want to lose your case in court, use these arguments. If you want to win your case in court, then you have to do something different, something new, unusual. You may not know what it is, but now you will know what not to do. And even if you don't know what to do and you do know what not to do, whatever it is you do decide to do will not be one of these dead losers. Let's take a look here at number 7. Now, we did 6 last time. Number 7 is called land patents. Back in 1983 or 1984, Carol Landy popularized an argument that the land patent was the highest and best form of title, and that by updating the patent in your own name, you could defeat any mortgages. This contention violated many principles of real property law, and when Carol Landy started trying to get patents for most of the land in California brought up in her own name, she went to jail. Others who have raised this argument have lost this issue as well, and he cited 7 cases here. Now, this land patent is a real legal title, and I have a land patent on my farm. And what the land patent is, in effect, it's a form of history of your property. And as such, the land patent, which on this farm was signed by President Wilson back in 1914, this property was then sold to a lady named Smith. Hale brought it up, sold it to a lady named Smith. Smith sold it to Davis. And there's only been 3 owners on this property. 4. I guess there's a 4th owner now. Now, there's a description of the land itself, and then there's the land patent, which is signed off by the United States government. President Woodrow Wilson says that the United States government quits its claim to this piece of land. But that doesn't mean you don't have to pay the property taxes, and many people have got it in their heads that if I've got the land patent brought up in my name, you can't charge me property taxes, and then the state comes in and takes your property away from you. Or if I have this brought up, I don't have to pay the mortgage, and then the bank forecloses on you and throws you out. Now, that's been going on for a long time. People are sincere. People really believe in this land patent issue. I remember Charlie Walters published this land patent thing in Acres USA back in the 80s. Charles Walters believed in it. And when I bring this to your attention, it's not to make fun of you. It's not to say, "Why, you dummy." Not at all. It's that it may have appeared to be a good, solid legal issue when it was tested. But no, once it's been tested, once you took it into court, presented your arguments, and you were ruled against, it creates what we call stare decisis. Once settled, always settled. Now, once the case has been decided, that's the end of it. Now, you can raise it in the appellate process and see if this trial court judge made a mistake. And if the appellate court rules against you again, you can take it to the Supreme Court. And if they rule against you, or if they decide that they're going to let the lower court ruling stand, you lose. The doctrine's been decided, and that's the way all the courts in America are going to rule. Now, I've had people say, "Well, that's not right." Well, okay, you're probably correct. That's not right, and probably it ought to be changed. But now it becomes a political question. It's up to the legislature to change it. Now, you see that happening right now in this Kello case, where the state of Connecticut, New London, Connecticut, was the city, and they condemned some property for redevelopment. They took the case up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, "Yeah, you can do that." And so many legislators really got irked by that. And so the Congress and many state legislators and legislatures are in the process of changing the law. I think Utah was the first one out of the chute. They came right out and said municipalities can't take private property for public use, period. Or they can't turn it over to somebody else. That's what it is. Can't turn it over to Holiday Inn to build a hotel for more tax revenue. All right. Now, that's the proper forum and format for that. Now, when that case is brought up in Utah, the Utah Supreme Court is going to tell some city or hamlet over here, "No, you can't do that." The legislature enacted legislation prohibiting it. So tuck away in your mind that once a case has been decided, like the Kello case, okay, well, now we know what the law is. Now you got to take a look at your state and see, well, what does your state say? And you may live in a state where they're going to take your property for the Holiday Inn. Just make sure that when they do, that you get just compensation. I've said before, and I'll say it again, it doesn't make any difference to me whether the government takes my land and builds a Navy base or takes my land and builds a Holiday Inn. My land is just as gone. Now, you can sit there and argue, well, they should take it for Navy base, but they shouldn't take it for Holiday Inn. Tell difference doesn't make it's gone. Now, when they take it for Navy base, I want to make sure that I get paid every dime that it's worth. And if they take it for Holiday Inn, I want to make sure that they get paid, or I get paid every dime it's worth. I just saw this the other day in the Kello case. I'll pass this on to you. The city of New London has now gone to the people who 5 years ago they condemned their property. Now, 5 years later, the Supreme Court comes back and rules, well, yeah, you can take their property. So the city of New London is charging those people rent for 5 years, so they're going to take their property and not pay them a dime. Well, you lived in our property for 5 years. We condemned it 5 years ago. Now listen, let me tell you, that isn't going to fly. And while the case is in litigation, everything is on hold until we get an answer to this. And I think that it's really outrageous that the state has got the gall. I mean, you got to be somebody with a lot of chutzpah to come in here and say, well, now that you've kept this property for 5 years and we didn't get to build our hotel 5 years ago, we're going to charge you rent for 5 years because we won the case. It's just so much poppycock and nonsense. And if that case comes back to the Supreme Court, I'll guarantee you the Supreme Court will jump on the city of New London and eat their lunch. But you can just about bet that the city of New London is going to settle with a number of those people for less than they originally offered them, because these people are now litigation tired. They've spent money for years and they're tired now and they haven't got any fight left in them. And so they'll capitulate. And that's what those lawyers are gambling on. I would take this case up to the Supreme Court, tie it up for another 5 years, and get another decision. But most people don't have what it takes to do that. So keep in mind, land patents then became popularized as an argument that doesn't have any merit. That while land patents, or a land patent is a legitimate, bona fide, legal methodology, it's a part of law, it does not mean that you can use it to go out here and take other people's property away from them or not pay your mortgage or taxes. Notice of levy, number 8. A popular argument currently circulating is that a mere notice of levy is not equal to a levy, and thus may not be used for tax collection purposes. The courts have not accepted this idea. And a number of cases here, the courts have not accepted this idea. See, I'm on page 4 here. Where's page 5? Let me flip over here to page 5. And there's 6 cases there on this thing of notice of levy. Perhaps there are some remaining methods to prevail on this argument, but serious damage has already been done. Now, here's what happens. Let's suppose that you've got an issue and you want to take it into court. like the Kello case on eminent domain. Now, the issue they brought up is, can they take this property, turn it over to the Holiday Inn to build a Holiday Inn to enhance tax revenue? The court says, yeah, they can. If they've got a legitimate plan. Now, they laid out a number of rules and guidelines that they've got to follow, in addition to the just compensation. Now, that doctrine's been floating around for a long time. It goes back to the 1940s. I remember after World War II, I mentioned this to you when I did the Kello series over here, that the city of Los Angeles condemned Chavez Ravine, took all that property there where now the Los Angeles Dodgers have their ballpark, took it away from all these poor Mexicans. And listen, it was for urban redevelopment, and the court said, yeah, they can do that. So the Fifth Amendment guarantees that you'll get compensation when the government takes it. It doesn't say what they're going to take it for is legal or illegal. Kello said, you can't take it for this purpose. Now, the court came in and said, yeah, they can. So forget about arguing about the purpose for which they're taking it. Concentrate on getting paid for it. It's just as gone. Your land is gone. So you got to argue the right issue. Now, once the issue has been settled, which it has been in Kello, don't waste your time coming in here saying you can't condemn my land for a Holiday Inn. That's already been settled. Concentrate on the real key issue, and that is you're not paying me enough money for my ground. You're cheating me out of some money. There's a lot of issues that can be raised along that line. For instance, I'm not getting just compensation when you give me the residential value for my property that you're condemning for the Holiday Inn, because when this is rezoned commercial, it's going to double, triple, or quadruple its value, and the people across the street get a windfall, and I get screwed. Therefore, there needs to be a formula put in here to compensate me adequately for this. So what the city of New London is going to do, they're going to come and take this residential property and pay them 10 cents on the dollar, zone it commercial, make it worth 10 times more money just by zoning it commercial, and then build Holiday Inns and shopping center, and et cetera. The people that live across the street from the Holiday Inn will then sell their property to Hardee's and get 10 times more for their property because it's been rezoned commercial. And the people who were residential got paid 10 cents on the dollar. That's an unjust profit. It's unjust enrichment. And that ought to be argued. Mrs. Kello didn't raise that issue, so the court didn't rule on it. I could think of 10 or 12 different arguments along that line that deal with just compensation. That's what you want to be arguing. So don't raise these dead letter arguments like land patents. It's just a dead letter issue and notice of levy, dead letter issue. Now, there might be an issue or two in there that could be raised, but make sure that you've read the literature and you know what the issues are the courts have ruled on, and don't raise those a second time. Here's the UCC argument. Have you heard about this UCC commercial law straw man? And there's a word that they use here in here. See if I see it. Affidavit of truth, commercial law, and there's another term, and I get to it over here, that's being espoused today. Now, it's pretty popular. I have people call me all the time and say, they'll tell me they want me to help them with their UCC argument here, you know, and I tell them, well, that's just frivolous nonsense, and boy, do they get miffed. I mean, they just come unhinged and call me stupid, and you don't know what you're talking about, and so on. Well, I didn't call you, partner. You called me, and you want to call me and have me help you succeed in something that you can't win. Nobody's ever won a case. Nobody's going to win a case. It's a frivolous argument. It's a dead letter issue. But Larry Beecraft actually researched it out, and it was pretty revealing. And here's the story. The UCC argument number 9. Back in the early 1990s, Hartford Van Dyke promoted the theory that commercial law was the foundation for all law around the world. And based upon Hartford's contention regarding commercial law, he developed the idea that an affidavit of truth submitted in commerce could create a lien which simply had to be paid. Hartford claimed that his findings were well known everywhere and that this lien process had been used for thousands of years. So I obtained his memo regarding this argument and I went to the law library. I found that his contentions that this principle manifested itself in the law was wrong. I couldn't find anything which supported this argument. His theory was a complete fabrication with absolutely no merit whatsoever. However, did other people act upon Hartford's ideas anyway? Well, Leroy Schweitzer of the Montana Freeman took Hartford's ideas to heart, and he claimed that he created liens against public officials. Then, based upon these liens, Leroy started issuing site drafts drawn upon some post office account and started passing them out to many gullible people who believed that such drafts were required to be paid by the feds. Not only did Leroy Schweitzer get into deep trouble, but so did many who got drafts from him. And there have been lots of people who have been prosecuted and convicted and jailed for using these site drafts allegedly justified by this theory. One of the most recent prosecutions of someone for using one of Leroy's drafts is Pete Stern, a patriot from North Carolina. Several years ago, Pete issued some of these drafts to the IRS. Pete has been one of the most vocal advocates of the UCC argument. We are Brits, nom de jure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, while I like Pete, still he has followed some very crazy arguments. Pete's federal criminal case is filed in the Western District of North Carolina, and you may visit the clerk's webpage by clicking here. Once you get to this page, look on the left side of the page to the sidebar and click on the case information section called Docket Image. When that page comes up, insert Pete's case number 2-1999-CR-00081 and his name. His file will come up and you can read all of his pleadings. Is he using for his own defense the arguments that he advocates? Now, as best as I can tell, the popular UCC argument has its origins in Hartford's work and the improvements made by Leroy. The UCC argument is one of the most legally baseless ideas that I have ever encountered, and yet organizations like Wrong Way Law, now he's got that in quotes, it's called Right Way Law by the people that have it. But Larry Beecraft calls it Wrong Way Law, and people like Jack Smith and Rick Schramm, who continue to promote this ludicrous idea. Now here are some published cases which have correctly rejected this lunacy. There are 8 cases cited here. I'm not gonna bore you by citing all of these names and numbers, but this has been brought up 8 times now. So these issues that are brought up concerning the straw man and commercial law and so on are just so much nonsense. Now, if you think that it's got merit, why don't you just run into court and just give it your all? But you're gonna lose just like everybody else. And if you want to lose, that's the route to take. It's guaranteed. Now, if you want to win, and if you've got some real case that's got some real legal merit, then there is a logical, systematic methodology for defense, and you ought to get with it. Remember, the law is the rule by which we play the game. You ought not to be breaking the law. By the time the IRS comes and files an action against you and charges you with willful failure to file or tax evasion, it's already too late. For practical purposes, it's too late. You want to get started before the indictment comes down. You want to get started before you willfully fail to file. You should know what the law is and what the rules are, and then don't violate the rules. You can bend them, you can stretch them, you can get up real close to them, but don't cross over. Now, the UCC argument is nothing but an expansion of Hartford Van Dyke's theory, and since Hartford never cited any law to support his idea, people who believed his nonsense started looking for anything to support their argument. To support this contention about commercial law, the advocates of this position have relied upon the case of Erie Railroad versus Tompkins, cited at 304 U.S. 64 in 1938. However, I just simply ask you to read this case and determine for yourself whether it supports the proposition of these advocates. And my advice is that if you hear anyone making some crazy argument about the Uniform Commercial Code, run away as fast as you can. The argument's crazy. The argument's crazy. They got a term that they use here, and I don't see it over here, but it's a UCC and straw man and commercial law, and then there's a word that they use that slips my mind right now. It's kind of preposterous, kind of like that codicil I mentioned to you in the last program. Codicil, an amendment to a will. What's that got to do with income tax? Nothing. But, you know, people that know very little about the law can come up with these legal terms or citations or cases and really bamboozle, especially lay people that aren't familiar with legal research or how to look up a law. So here Larry Beecraft says, here's these people, they're citing Erie Railroad. Erie Railroad is still the law of the land, and last time I heard, and Erie Railroad makes good legal sense. But Erie Railroad doesn't make any legal sense for the Uniform Commercial Code. It's not about the Uniform Commercial Code. It's about an insurance company and an accident. And if you read these cases, you know, they'll pretty much tell you where the bear does it and where the rubber meets the road. And even if you're a truck driver and you've only got a limited education, you didn't go to college, and you're saying to yourself, God, I'm just not too smart. I tell you, partner, you can read those court cases. And you might be bamboozled by some Latin terms or by some word that you've never heard before. But when you read this case, any case that the Supreme Court publishes, I think you'll be able to grasp it. If you can read a newspaper, you can read a court case. Now, you might not agree with it, you might not like the outcome, and you might say, well, I would, you know, like Kello, you know, everybody is up in arms about the Supreme Court's decision in Kello. And I'm simply sitting there saying, well, I don't think you'll have any problem reading the Kello case. Why don't you read it and listen to the Supreme Court's reasoning? Here's why we ruled this way. Here's what our answer to the question is. And that's the law of the land. That's the way the game is going to be played from now on. So get used to it. That's the way the game is going to be played unless it's changed by your legislature. Now, Larry Beecraft has taken the time to analyze these legal arguments and research out the cases that show you that, hey, listen, if you make this legal argument, you're going to lose, and here's why you're going to lose. Now, I'm going to add one more little comment here. In the Bible, God tells us not to use unjust weights and balances. You'll see that in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36 and Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. He says, don't use unjust weights and balances. Use gold and silver coin. Use just weights and balances. So, stocks and bonds, commercial paper, site drafts, These are unjust weights and balances. This is commercial paper. This is what got us into trouble with this Federal Reserve to start with. Our founding fathers followed just weights and balances and gave us gold and silver coin. Then Congress said, well, we got to have paper money. And then in 1933, Roosevelt, under House Joint Resolution 192, took our gold away. Johnson took our silver away. And today we have fiat currency. This is the ultimate end result of deviating from God's instruction concerning just weights and balances. Now, if you go out here and play this unjust weights and balances game, you're likely to get yourself into trouble. I think you'd be better advised. Just stay away from unjust weights and balances. If you stay out of the stock market, stay out of the bond market, stay out of Federal Reserve notes and checks, commercial paper, mortgages, interest and usury, and all the rest of the crap that goes with it, you'll make more money in the end, and you'll live better, and you'll be happier. That's been my experience. To learn how to do that, just call the law school, and we'll tell you more. The number here is area code 417-273-4967. If you've got a question concerning these crazy arguments, we'll tell you. We do this every day, and we're pretty thick-skinned. You're not going to offend us. You can call up and say, well, do you think that this argument on nom de jure has got any merit? And we'll say, no, none at all, zero. How about the CFR cross-reference index? Has that got any merit? Let's take a look at it. The Code of Federal Regulations contains a separate volume which lists various statutes and the regulations which implement those statutes. This particular publication is not an exclusive list, nor is it an admission made by the government that there are no regulations for Title 26 USC, and parties making this argument have suffered defeat. And there are five of them. The CFR cross-reference index. So you have a Code of Federal Regulations. If you're a person who is a taxpayer, the Code of Federal Regulations applies to you. If you're a non-taxpayer, the Code of Federal Regulations does not apply to you as it relates to taxes. That's simple enough, isn't it? So now the people, they'll say, well, the CFR doesn't apply to me. Well, how do you know it doesn't? Do you know what makes that apply to you? Now, the traffic regulations apply to you if you have a driver's license. If you don't have a driver's license, they don't apply to you. Now, the law that says thou shalt have a driver's license might apply to you, but the law that says drive on the right side of the road doesn't. You ought not to be driving on the road to start with, and so if you don't have a driver's license, you couldn't be out there driving, or at least you're not supposed to. So when we're trying to find fault, and we go to the law, and then we start looking at the statutes, the codes, and the regulations, if you're a arms dealer, now I own a gun or two, but I'm not an arms dealer, and I don't have a federal license. So the federal regulations that regulate gun stores and gun salesmen and so on don't apply to me because I'm not one of them. I haven't volunteered into that regulated enterprise. But when you get a Social Security number, you become a taxpayer. If you get a federal tax ID number, you get to be a taxpayer, and then the CFR applies to you. That's the way that system works. So then when you say, well, the CFR doesn't apply to me, it's like a soldier in the Army saying that the Uniform Code of Military Justice doesn't apply to me. Boys and girls, that's the only law that applies to you. So many people have got this thing backward, and they go out here and they want to come under the Uniform Commercial Code. Boys and girls, the Uniform Commercial Code is the basis for the income tax, not your salvation. It's the problem. It's the cause of your problem. Unjust weights and balances. You have to stay away from it. We'll take a look at the flag issue. Remember the fringe on your flag? What does that mean? What legal significance does it have when we come back? Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States, around the world, over the Internet. And for more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, economics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. And they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station, although they should. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org or call the Law School 417-273-4967. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're looking at and reviewing some destroyed arguments. There's about 30 of them here, as I recall. Larry B. Craft put this together. You can go to Larry B. Craft's webpage. It's http:// fly, F-L-Y, dot highway, H-I-W-A-A-Y, dot net. Kind of an odd spelling for that highway, but there's two A's in it. That's what makes it odd. http://fly.highway, H-I-W-A-A-Y.net. You're looking for destroyed arguments. Here's number 11, the flag issue. Now, a currently popular argument is that the gold-fringed flag indicates the admiralty jurisdiction of the court. Naturally, pro se litigants have made this argument, and they have lost. And he's got six of them cited here. Of course, there are other decisions which have not been published, but against all odds, Dave Miller still travels the country promoting this lost cause. I don't know who Dave Miller is, but I guess Larry does, and the guy is promoting this lost cause, just like Right Way Law goes out promoting this thing of the UCC. These various and sundry arguments that have been made oftentimes by what I think are government agents. I don't have any proof for that, but I can't imagine anybody other than your enemy making this argument for you. In other words, what better way is there to defeat you than to convince you to make an argument that has no legal basis? Then when I come into court, I make my case against you. And instead of you defending yourself against my allegations, you start talking about the fringed flag. You never answer my allegations. I may be dead wrong. You may be as innocent and pure as the driven snow. But you can't win because you're not arguing your defense. You're arguing some argument that doesn't have any merit. And so you have failed then to defend yourself adequately, and therefore you lose. I've always been suspicious about fifth columnists. I've always thought that the Pilot Connection was in reality an IRS front organization with a symbiotic relationship like a pilot fish cleaning a shark's tooth. And that the arguments and the defenses that were made by the Pilot Connection, which all lost, nobody could win, but it sucked in all of the patriots, and then the IRS went in and raided the Pilot Connection and got the names and addresses. It's just like getting leads for an insurance salesman. They have a contest and they say, well, send in your name and address and two bits and a box top to Kellogg's Battle Creek, Michigan, and we'll send you back thus and such. Now they've got a mailing list and they can send their salesman out to talk to you. They know that you're interested in this thing over here. I think the IRS works the same way, although I don't have any direct evidence that that's the case, but I can't imagine many of these arguments, as frivolous as they are, being made by anybody that's on our side. So don't get mad at Larry Beecraft or George Gordon for exposing these frauds like Rick Schramm and Jack Smith. In fact, Jack Smith admitted to Larry one time and said, he asked him, he said, have you got any hard evidence of this? And Schramm said, no, it's just theory. Well, when you got a theory, it's just that. This is my idea. I don't think you'd want to stake 5 years in prison on somebody else's idea. At least be staking your 5 years of imprisonment on your own idea, not somebody else's. And they're out selling these packages, you know, for $75 or $150. In some cases, I've heard of people selling these kinds of nutty packages for thousands of dollars. And it's not $75 or $7,500. It's the fact that it doesn't have any legal merit. That's the bottom line. It's got to have some legal merit. It's at least bring up an argument that's never been argued before. The flag issue has been argued many, many times, off point and out of context, and has nothing to do. You're charged with driving without a license, and you come into court and argue that the flag's got a fringe on it. What better place to have a fringe on a flag than in a traffic court, which is, in fact, an admiralty court, which is charging you, a sea captain, for operating a vessel called a vehicle on a river of tar, backing up to docks and steering around islands with a flag on your vessel at both ends called a license plate without having your seaman's papers. I mean, come on, guys, that's admiralty. If there ever was a court that needed a fringe flag, it's your local traffic court. That is an admiralty court. Common law court. These courts have been declared non-existent. And then he cites one case, Kimmel versus Burnett County Appraisal District down in Texas. Common law court. Maybe you heard about this. It's been about 10 years now. But there was an outfit called the Republic of Texas. And they were pretty popular among patriots down in Texas. And they got off on this common law court thing. And somebody introduced me to it. And they were describing it. And I was at a patriot meeting down there. And it was Austin, Texas. And they're telling me about all these great things about this common law court. Now, if you want to read about common law courts, you read Blackstone's commentaries. Lord Blackstone wrote Blackstone's commentaries, I think it was in 1757 or something like that. And if you want to know how the old common law worked, and you can see remnants of that common law work in American law today, then you go to Kent's commentaries. Kent's commentaries tells you a little more about how the common law works in America. For practical purposes, the common law has been legislated out of existence, and the 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto and the Roman civil law have been legislated into their place. That's where you're at with the Kellogg case. All we've done here is we've taken the old common law on eminent domain and replaced it with the Communist Manifesto. That's the abolition of all right to property, the first plank, and then coupled that with the Roman civil law. That's what we've done. Now, there are people that get real excited about the common law, just like they get real excited about juries. And I'm not opposed to jury trials. It's just that the juries decide issues of fact. And for most pro se litigants, the truth is that you want to argue an issue of law. You can't take the money issue into a jury trial. The money issue is a legal issue that has to be tried in front of the judge. Now, somebody's going to say, well, that's not right. The jury should decide both the law and the facts. Well, I agree. I think you're right. They should, but they don't. The rules have been changed. I didn't change the rules, and I'm not going to change the rules back by violating the rules that exist today. Now, in the olden days, the jury was the barrier between the king's equity and you and I, the lay people. It was the jury that protected us from the king's law. Now, if you'll go to a case called Hale versus Hinkle, the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1905 said plainly that a grand jury is nothing more than a prosecutorial tool. Judges aren't stupid. Judges aren't ignorant. Judges know what the hell's going on. Politicians, I'm not sure, know which end is border punched, but judges do. And I'll guarantee you, all the federal judges do. There might be some state court judges that are a little out to lunch, but not the feds. But a federal court judge has a job to do, and he does it. And I kind of like Judge Roberts in his confirmation hearing. I think it was Dianne Feinsteiner, or no, I guess it was the Senator Durbin from Illinois. He said, are you going to be sensitive to the little guy? Are you going to rule for the little guy? And the judge said, well, how do I know who I'm going to rule for? My job is to construe the Constitution. If the little guy comes into court and he's right, he's going to win in my court. If the big guy comes in and he's right, then the big guy's going to win in my court. It isn't going to be, I'm going to rule for the little guy against the big guy, irrespective of who's right and who's wrong. I'm going to rule for what's right, irrespective of who brings the case in, which is exactly what law is all about. And that's exactly what God Almighty told us to do in Deuteronomy 1. He said, don't you give favor to the rich over the poor, or the poor over the rich, but judge righteous judgment. I don't know if Roberts is going to do that, but he said he was. He told Durbin, he said, my job is to come in here and rule for who's right, not to come in here and pick on who's the weak and who's the oppressed and who's the little guy. Hell, even the little guys can be wrong. And a little guy who comes into court arguing the flag issue is wrong. The little guy that comes into court arguing that the CFR cross-reference index doesn't apply to him is wrong. The little guy that comes in making this UCC argument is wrong. And the big guy, the prosecuting attorney from the Justice Department, is going to win. Now, if we want to stop that, then us little guys down here have to get our heads on square on our shoulders and come in here and make some legal arguments that make sense. And that's what Larry Beecraft's trying to do here. He's trying to tell you, hey, look, guys and gals, you're making a bunch of dumbass arguments that's only going to get you thrown into prison. Now, why don't you clean up your act and let's see if we can do something more intelligent. And to that, I just say, well, amen, brother. I think you're exactly right. Let's listen to nom de jure. Like this common law court, they've been declared to be non-existent. They don't have any merit. They're just nonsense. Nonsense. Nom de jure, number 13. According to a book written by Berkheimer, a nom de jure, or nom de guerre, is a war name symbolized by a given name being written in capital letters. The argument contends that because of events in 1933, we've been made enemies, and government indicates our status as enemies by the nom de jure. If this is true, then why have the styles of the decisions of the United States Supreme Court since its establishment been in all capital letters? This argument has gotten lots of people into trouble. For example, Mike Kemp of the Gadsden Militia defended himself on state criminal charges with this argument, and he was thrown into jail. I've not even seen a decent brief on this issue, which was predicated upon cases that you can find in any ordinary law library. In any event, several courts have rejected this argument. And I've seen that a time or two. You know, some guy says, well, that's not my name. Well, okay. Or that's not my Christian name, or that's not this or that or something else. All you can say about that is that it's harmless error. They spelled your name incorrectly, harmless error. One time I sued a doctor and I spelled her name incorrectly, but her defense team didn't come in and say, hey, listen, you got the wrong person here. They were smart enough to come in and say, well, you dummy, you misspelled her name. Here's the way to spell it. So I corrected it after that, and we all got on with the lawsuit. But listen, it's an argument that people are using, and they absolutely believe in it. I've had people, you know, very serious people. People that aren't necessarily, you know, looked upon as being kooks, dentists, chiropractors, medical doctors. They've bought into this argument. They've got degrees after their names, and we think they're pretty smart people. Just because you've been to college doesn't make you all that smart. So if you think you're pretty smart, well, you know, you might not be as smart as you think you are. In any event, let's see how many cases here of this nom de jure. Oh, God, 11. 11 cases he's got down here. This nom de guerre position is one rabidly advocated by wrong-way law. It is all based upon hype and emotion. The speakers who advocate this argument know how to push the emotional hot buttons at Patriot pep rallies. I have reviewed the best briefs regarding this issue, and they're all trash. And yet I continue to see people call themselves John of Smith, etc. And I just simply conclude that such parties have attended a wrong way law seminar and have accepted a pack of lies. I want to pause right here. Lies. I'm going to underline lies. And that's because in fraud, it comes in two forms. It's actual or constructive fraud. An actual fraud is where I lie to you. And I know I'm lying to you, and I'm doing it for a purpose. And when Larry Becraft uses the word lie here, L-I-E-S, it's a pack of lies. I don't think he's doing it accidentally. I think he did that on purpose, and then I would concur with him. Rick Schramm and Jack Smith both know that that's poppycock. Poppycock. And they sell it because it makes money. And there was another guy on here that I exposed not too long back. It's been a couple of years now, I guess. But his name was Dennis something or other, and he was selling these energy machines. I've forgotten his last name now, Dennis something or other. And I took him to task, and I said, hey, listen, you know, if you don't like it, why don't you sue me and charge me with libel and slander and give me a bloody bully pulpit and let me go into court over here and expose you for the manifest liar that you are. And I think that's where Schramm and Smith need to be at the same time. A constructive fraud is a fraud where you're lying to people, but you actually believe that what you're telling them is the truth. You yourself are deceived by this false representation. But in the case of Schramm and Smith, they know that what they're telling you is a lie, and it's an actual fraud. They're actually doing it to make money. So I don't think Becraft made a mistake when he said it's a pack of lies. Further, it is remarkable that all the people who believe this idea have never checked it out. They just accept it because some patriot guru claimed that it was correct. So you want to remember this. When you go to some patriot meeting, and you listen to this story, you know, I was out at the World Congress of Science here some years back, and there was a speaker up there, and God, he just told a hell of a story. I forget what the nonsense was, but it was a hell of a story, and the audience was just applauding and clapping and jumping up and down upon the ground, biting the bushes and just eating it up. I turned to my wife and I said, well, in 5 years, that guy will be in prison. Well, I don't know if he's in prison, but he's on the lam. I know that. Just heard, I don't know, about a year ago that the guy was being sought after by the FBI. He's on their wanted list because of his fraud, tax fraud. And a lot of times these guys are out here selling these tax fraud schemes, and they file and pay their taxes. They don't even follow their own advice. They don't follow their own program. Now, Erwin Schiff, you know, he was a straight shooter, as far as I could tell. I've talked to him for quite a few years now, but I knew him years ago when he was on the lecture circuit, and I was on the lecture circuit, and we crossed paths every once in a while. I think Erwin Schiff actually believed the nonsense that he was selling. It was just as false, just as much nonsense. And tragically, many, many people went to prison following the Erwin Schiff program. And I've often said, well, if you want to go to jail like Erwin Schiff, he's been to jail three times. If you want to go to jail, follow the Erwin Schiff program. It's almost guaranteed. How can you fail? I mean, this guy's a proven winner. If you want to go to prison, follow the Erwin Schiff program. This guy has followed it himself and gone to prison three times. How can you miss if that's your objective? Now, my objective is not to go to prison. I don't really have any great desire to go to prison. I've been in jail a number of times. I know what jail is. I know what it's for, how intimidating and dehumanizing it is. I understand that. And you know, all of the apostles went to jail. Peter went to prison. Remember, there was an earthquake, and he was in prison. Peter, Paul, James, and John. Paul complained. You know, he said, listen, I've been in prison often. I've been locked up in the slammer. And, you know, maybe I'll have to go to jail again before it's all said and done. I hope not, but if it comes to that, I'm prepared to go. I can handle jail. I've been there before. I can go again. It's kind of like the Army, you know. We've been there before, and we can do it again. We don't like it, but, you know, we know how to handle it. And so if you want to go to jail, follow Erwin Schiff, follow these kinds of arguments, and I'm sure that you can succeed in going to jail. If you want to stay out of jail, stay away from these arguments. Try one more. Title 26 is not positive law. One of the files on my webpage contains a good memo explaining the titles of the code and why they were adopted. But against this explanation, people still run around asserting a contrary and groundless position. See Ryan versus Bilby, stating that Congress's failure to enact a title into positive law has only evidentiary significance and does not render the underlying enactment invalid or unenforceable. United States versus Zugor. Holding that the failure of Congress to enact a title as such and in such form into positive law in no way impugns the validity, effect, enforceability, or constitutionality of the laws as contained and set forth in the title. And a number of other cases asserting that even if Title 26 was not itself enacted into positive law, that does not mean that the laws under that Title 26 are null and void. Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated versus United States. Now, do you know who Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated is? I mean, that's one of the biggest, you know, isn't that Buffett? One of the biggest entrepreneurs and investors in the world owns this company called Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated versus United States. They went in there and argued Title 26 is not positive law and lost. So you can bet that the best lawyers that money can buy went in and made the argument, probably believed that 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 was true. And the court came back and said, no, it's not so. Now, the difference between positive law and negative law, I'm not going to get into that. There's no such thing as negative law, but there is such a thing as positive law. The Congress enacts laws into what they call positive law because they're not changed. Title 26 is changed every year. Any title that is changed constantly is never enacted into positive law. And Beecraft has a page. He says, one of the files on my webpage contains a good memo explaining these titles of the code and why they were adopted. Why don't you go to Larry Beecraft's website? Remember that website again is http://fly.highway.net. And he's got an article on there, and he'll tell you about that. I don't want to get into positive law here myself, but I think he's exactly correct. That argument, I have heard that argued before, and it lost. So don't walk in there and say, well, the reason I didn't file my tax return is because Title 26 isn't positive law, and therefore it doesn't apply to me, and I don't have to file. You lose. Now, we're up to number 14. The Title 26 is not positive law, is number 14. And if you use that argument, you're going to lose just like these guys lost. Now, he's got, probably five or six cases cited in here. Ryan versus Bilby, Berkshire Hathaway versus United States, and a couple others in here, Young versus IRS, and another couple. Those cases are available on Larry Beecraft's webpage. I gave you the site. Why don't you go to it and pull this article off of there. I think it'll be well worth your time. We'll take this up again next time. And we'll cover number 15, the 14th Amendment. And to give you an idea here, I got another minute here. Implementing regulations, taxes are contractual, simple facts regarding the we are subjects of the British Crown. And that's kind of a long one, we are subjects of the British Crown. Citizenship, the law is not copyrighted. And the straw man cite drafts. I was going to make a comment on that straw man cite drafts. He's got that here, number 22. Quite a little story on that. I'll give you that information as we progress along. The birth certificate is not the basis for the creation of credit in this country, and so on. There's a lot of beliefs and ideas that are circulating around patriot circles, but that doesn't mean that they've got any legal merit. All right, I'm about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back there tomorrow night, same time, same station. In the meantime, remember you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and good night, friends.